In June this year, David Anderson was elevated to the Legislative Council, leaving a House of Keys seat vacant and triggering a by-election in Glenfaber. Glenfaber extends down the middle section of the west coast of the island, bordering Michael to the north and Rushen to the south, and it's wrapped around Peel on three sides and is made up of the parishes of German and Patrick. In the 2011 census, the constituency had a population of 2,555, and no doubt it's more now. And voters represented around 78.9% of the overall population, and the turnout at the last general election was 66.4%. Two candidates have filed their papers for this by-election, which takes place next Thursday, the 10th of September. They are, in alphabetical order, Geoffrey Boot, a company director, and he's also served on various UK local authorities, and David Talbot, a chartered secretary and accountant and a Patrick commissioner. Both independent candidates are with me today in the studio to discuss some of the issues raised by their manifestos and to explore their views on some topics of general and national interest. Well, gentlemen, good afternoon and thank you for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Roger.
Good afternoon, yes.
But first, we begin with, in the traditional manner for these programmes, and before we enter our conversation, each candidate, each of you, is given 2 minutes uninterrupted to talk to us about any matter of your personal choice. And this too is in alphabetical order, which means we start with Geoffrey Boot.
Thank you very much, Roger. Yes, it's been a short campaign, but I can safely say that I've knocked on nearly every door in the constituency and had some interesting grown-up conversations. As always, local issues feature, and there are a lot of them, but there is also great disappointment in the present administration. It all started well and people were generally braced for the necessary readjustments to our economy, but somewhere along the way, government lost direction. The result, a public sector that is demoralised with fears over job security, redundancy and changing pension provision. Although a lot's been going on under the radar, this lack of morale and in some cases leadership needs addressing. The private sector continues to view the public sector with suspicion as they have faced cutbacks, increasing retirement age and uncertainty over job security, coupled with big business from across paying little or no tax, competing unfairly with some of our island businesses. Both sectors rely on each other. Without functioning public services and good infrastructure, we will not be able to attract new businesses, and no one wants to see vulnerable people put at risk. The government has of late announced a number of initiatives to encourage new business and grow existing companies. This is key to economic growth, which will increase valuable tax streams, without which we simply will have insufficient money to finance our public services and future pensions. I support these initiatives. I see economic growth as being one of the island's key issues and a priority. Running a country is like running a business. I have built a number of businesses concentrating on detail and delivering what the customer wants, as well as facing the challenge of regulation. These are skills I believe MHKs require.
All right, thank you very much. That was Geoffrey Boot. And now David Talbot.
Thank you, Roger. I think there are three things we ought to mention in this programme. First of all, what the government agenda is at the moment. They've issued a report securing a substantial, sustainable future for our island. And that needs looking at carefully what they propose to do in the final year of their administration. Then we need to look at what we're proposed by way of policy and action points we'd like to see implemented. But undergirding all of that will be constituency work, because we're often asked, well, what are you going to do in such a short period of time? But constituency work will start on the 11th of September. And we need to hit the ground running with the issues in the constituency, working with commissioners on the key issues, some of which I've initiated and brought about and would like to see these continue. I'm certainly very keen on the area plan which we're putting together for the west of the island, which brings together five local authorities and creating a plan which will fit into the government's strategic plan of 2015. Whilst the economy is doing very well, we just had figures out for 2013-14, which shows a fourth decade of continuous growth, GDP at 4.32 billion, a rise of some 4.5% over the previous year. It's interesting to look at the breakdown of that, because informal communications up 58%, e-gaming up 30%, construction showing a pleasing increase of 17%, but tourism and retail have shown a rapid decline. So looking at the government's agenda for change, we need to examine and break down the parts of that. But I'm looking forward to serve in the community if I'm elected, and trust I can bring the skills and abilities which I've learned throughout my working career.
Right, thank you very much, Frank David. That was David Talbot, and before him, Geoffrey Boot. Well, now, gentlemen, both of you have distributed manifestos with some similar characteristics to both of them, as you might expect, and some differences. But both of you referred very clearly to the trust. You talked about disquiet in the public. You talk about restoration of the trust in your manifesto. Can you explain that, David? Restoration of trust. That implies that trust has been lost.
I think the key thing that people are saying throughout the constituency is that they don't in actual fact trust what our politicians are saying. This is not an Isle of Man thing. The mood music generally in the UK is that whenever a politician makes an announcement, we look for what actually is underneath all of that and where they're actually trying to take us. And there's no doubt about it, where people trust each other, then there is a speed of action and a motivation which gets things done. Where there's no trust, we tend to grind to a halt or move very, very slowly forward. So we need to work on that. And some of the things that were outstanding are still outstanding, such as the Equality Act, such as the Freedom of Information, although that's passed now, we're still waiting for that to be implemented from next year. And also my own particular interest, that of the credit union legislation, which needs to be changed and updated. I think these are just features of how we can improve the trust throughout the government and our citizens.
Right, okay, well, we'll come back to that. Now, you didn't actually use the word trust, Geoffrey, but you did imply much the same sort of thing, that there was a disquiet.
Well, I think there is a disquiet when you start talking to people and you have a proper conversation with them. They don't really know what's going on with government, and sometimes they feel that they're being led in directions that they don't want to go in. I said in my beginning, at the beginning, there's disappointment in the present administration, but I think that's common with most administrations at this stage. But there were opportunities and people were willing to bend and do things, but we seem to have lost momentum. The pension reform has been put on the back burner, and it'll be before a new Tynwald next year, and some things that should have been done have not really been grasped.
But you're going to have, this is going to happen anyway, because if people who go into government, I don't mean parliament, I'm talking about government now, and they're going to have to take tough decisions, and you cannot please all the people all the time. There's going to be a lot of dissatisfied people out there whose things haven't gone quite as they expected it.
Yeah, I think in terms of, certainly in terms of the pension, there are four proposals that Finance Minister brought to Tynwald this last year, and they're turned into recommendations, which he has got to go away and actually turn into proper recommendations, one in actual fact in October and the other three next February. I think it's important that these are dealt with in this administration before we wait till next year. And certainly one of the key features will be for both of us will be our ability to work with existing backbenchers and ministers to bring about the changes that we've that detailed in our manifestos.
Well, that, of course, does take us to the point, isn't it, Geoffrey? But how would you, as one man, make a difference, especially in under a year?
That is the big problem, and I would be lying if I told you that I'm going to make a big difference. The truth of the matter is, either of us gets elected, we're going to get in there, we'll try and make our mark, but we're going to learn the system and see what happens, and hopefully win the trust of the electorate for a five-year mandate when we can really make a difference.
So you see this term of office as setting down the foundations for a longer political career?
That's what it's going to be.
I think it is a six-year project in which the first 12 months, I tend to disagree slightly with Geoffrey there. I think the next 12 months, in actual fact, will be undergirded by constituency work. We can't wait for 12 months for that. So I think it's very important that we set up our systems and are able to deal with constituency matters away.
That's a said, though. We've got to do that. We know that. Both of us know that, having spoken to people. But when it comes to government and Tynwald, it's going to be difficult to make much of an impression.
Well, that's where I differ, actually, from Geoffrey, in that I think my work in the Municipal Association and commissioners has actually helped me enormously to build relationships up with politicians, whether ministers or backbenchers. So I think it's very helpful to be able to to get on with the job right away. And if you've got already relationships set up, that's very helpful.
Well, I think I should say there, because Roger didn't mention at the beginning that I am also a German commissioner, and I've been working in the community as well. But I think where we're differing here is that I know what's going to happen over the next 10 months of Timwold. People are going to keep their heads down. They're not going to do anything controversial because they'll be worried about the next general election and getting re-elected. And I think that's where things are going to slow down, or the legislative programmes are not going to progress the way we would perhaps like to see them progress. But that's that's common in all administrations here and across in the last few months.
Let me ask you both then the same question. First of all, David, with the 1 year we're talking about, not any longer term perhaps, but bearing in mind the constituency boundaries will have changed as well, and you and Peel will be combined together, and it'll be different hustings at that time. What will be, if elected, your main challenge in just under 1 year?
Well, I think there are a couple of things which I mentioned in my manifesto, which I'm very keen about. Obviously, the credit union legislation, which we've been campaigning for the last 2 to 2.5 years, I want to see that brought to the fore and looked at all options with regard to that. Also, I think it would be possible to see what common ground there is for reforming LegCo. I'm proposing quite a simple bill, which will enable the two houses to be separated and brought together only perhaps for ceremonial occasions, but that each gets on with its job of bringing forward legislation and the other one actually scrutinising. So I think it's possible to do some stuff, but essentially it will be constituency work, and it will be building relationships, and it will be actually looking at Peel, as you've mentioned, because we can't kid ourselves that we're going to be together next year. So effectively, from the 11th of September, we've also got to be looking at what's happening in Peel.
Right, and Geoffrey, you, what would be your main challenge?
Well, I think constituency work is where it's at, and trying to put some of the communication issues right between the electorate and the MHK. But as David says, there are things that need doing, but I really don't think it's realistic to expect things like LegCo and what have you, reform within
the
next 10
years. Are the public really that interested in it,
I don't think they are. It's not something that comes up on the doorstep very often. And I think the way the election of Legislative Council members was perpetrated is not good and is embarrassing when you follow it. And that could definitely do with being reformed. I don't like the idea, for instance, that MHKs who are standing can vote for themselves. That seems to put them at an unfair advantage against candidates from outside.
Now, after all, an election to a national government, and let's perhaps deal with some of those national issues for a minute. And any national issue is bound to be the communication between the parliament and the government of the country and its people. Now, you're implying, Geoffrey, that there isn't communication there, but there must be someone. We wouldn't get as far as they have without any.
You are correct. I'm talking more about, in communication terms, the MHK communicating with the electorate, but
don't they all do that? The telephone number's in the book, they're easily accessible.
But I think there are ways of communicating with websites and blogs and Facebook and things that are new, and people can follow what you're doing. But so when it comes to government, I mean, yes, they do consult. I looked at the list the other day, and I think there's 16 items out for consultation at the moment, less than there have been in the past, but people, it's true, don't respond to these consultations, which is also sad, and perhaps they don't get enough publicity, I don't know.
Now, you said in your manifesto, David, I'm quoting the exact line, it says, whatever goes on will only mask the underlying systematic failings and silo mentality that is crippling our island. That's a bold statement.
Yes, well, I mean, I think most ministers would, in actual fact, agree with that, because I hear that regularly from certain ministers who come to visit us at the Municipal Association and so on, really. I think the silo mentality is one which is going to be addressed by the single legal entity, which the Chief Minister has put out a consultation for. I think he recognises that unless we do begin to work together and do come out of our silos, do look at budgeting in a different way, we're going to still be clogging up the system. We're still going to be thinking just about my department and my group, my people, instead of actually working together. It has in actual fact meant that a lot of activity that should have gone on by now has been stopped by interdepartmental wrangles.
But crippling?
Well, crippling in the sense that We're just not making progress, for example, on certain things that I've already mentioned to you before, which mean that instead of moving forward quickly, whether it be lack of trust or empire building, whatever it might be, we're not making the progress we should do. And I trust that over the next 12 months we'll see a change, and certainly the new parliament from September next year, we ought to start dealing with these issues.
What do you make of the single entity government proposal?
Well, I've looked through the document and I don't actually agree with it. I think most people perceive government as being a single legal entity.
It's anyway. Not.
I know it's not. There are departments, but I visited the Scottish Parliament, which is based on a single legal entity, and I still see interdepartmental competition for funding, and you can't do away with that in a single stroke of the pen. And I think at the moment where we're short of money, we are changing things for changing things' sake. What we should be doing is looking a little bit harder at department budgets and getting them to work together within the present system. Without all change, more money spent, and we end up with basically government in the same form but with a different name. And there's also confidentiality issues, and I understand that they can probably be solved, but when you have a single legal entity and the whole of government is talking to each other, then personal records and what have you will be available within the whole structure.
But the singularly lack of response to the consultation does show that perhaps it hasn't caught the imagination of the general public this year.
Well, I think that consultations generally are fairly poorly responded to. It's the discussion really that's going on at the moment. Single legal entity sounds quite frightening in some respects, but if it does address the fact that there is a silo mentality which hasn't been solved,
doesn't mean to say, of course, if they bring in single legal entity that the ministerial system will change.
No, Roger, I don't think it will, to be honest. And I think we're naive to think that it will change. If you look at what happens in Scotland, are their outcomes any better than the UK government as a whole? They're not. And if you look at and talk to the ministers and people involved, there's still what David calls a silo mentality.
There is a problem within the system that things take too long, though, Geoffrey.
I think that we've got 85,000 people on this island, and 85,000 people can surely work together in a much better way than 5 million people in Scotland.
And okay, how would you assist in this?
Well, I think what we need is a bit of oil in the machinery, really, here. We need to actually bring some new ideas, some new blood, some new encouragements for our government to actually begin to work closer together. I mean, we proved this in local authorities, where the five local authorities in the west of the island work remarkably well together, and as effectively by working together in such a way, we've defeated the argument about regionalisation. We proved the point that you can, in actual fact, produce the results at a better cost, keep the service quality up without, in actual fact, having to join together.
But that's an argument against a single legal entity, because we are individual boards that work together, and the departments at the moment obviously work together, and they're perceived by the public as government, as it were. And I don't think people want to see drastic change and cost.
Yeah, we have a single government in the sense that of taxation. I mean, it's the Treasury, and it's the existing system that imposes all the different levels of tax on us all. Now, you're talking about fairness and equitable distribution of the taxation burden, David. I mean, what is wrong with the present system we have?
Well, the present system means that those at the wealthy end pay a much smaller amount of their income by way of tax. Now, it's still a very large amount and is well in excess of the average person. However, whereas frontline services are being affected, reduced, quality diminishing, hospital waiting lists taking a long time to get to the surgery and so on and so forth, I perceive eventually there'll be a rebellion against that, some social unrest, unless we in actual fact begin to address the inequity which is creeping into the system. And I think that demonstrates itself by a much lower output of quality and quantity of services that are available at the moment. We've tolerated a kind of two-society system whereby, we accept the fact that those who come to live on the Isleman with some wealth pay a proportionate lot amount of tax, but where you begin to nibble at where the services are received at the other end, then I think there will be some disquiet about that.
Now, you're talking about a widening of the net of the zero-10 taxation policy for corporates as well. Yeah, Geoffrey's talking about needing a larger tax base. How do you work that
out? Well, the government has recently talked about expanding the workforce, and they use some unfortunate rhetoric, 15,000 new people, and it sounded fairly drastic. But really, we need to get more people in the workforce, particularly the private sector, paying tax, because that expands the tax base. I'm slightly concerned that David's... Well, it seems to be a support for increasing taxes, particularly on top end. Well, it leads that way, David. I think we've got to be very careful. The island is perceived as a low tax economy, which compensates to a certain extent for the cost of living. But we need to keep business on Ireland. We're a very small business base, and you only have to start talking about increasing taxes and taking more tax, and some of the businesses that are situated here will move jurisdiction. It's so easy, and people are very mobile nowadays. I think the readjustments to allowances that have recently been announced are good news. I think it's going to be 14,000 before people pay tax. I like the idea of a flat tax system of 20%. After that, I think that's fair and equitable, and it encourages people to work. Whereas if you look at other jurisdictions where the tax tech or the tax rate goes up, the more you earn, that seems to be demotivating in the way that you earn more and then pay more.
Well, you mentioned there the 15,000. That was mentioned on one of these programmes a few weeks ago by the Chamber of Commerce, who believed they needed another 15,000 people to come into the Isle of Man to support the needs of business. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think there are two things there. First of all, if we are to increase economic activity, then you will need more people to work. But the underlying point really is that if that happens, then that threatens the nice countryside cosy feeling that perhaps we've enjoyed for so long.
But if we
do want that, then we're in a position where we need to be addressing the underlying problem, which is in actual fact the cost of running government. And we're only running government at the present cost on the basis of the income that we've got. Now, if we're saying that we need to increase economic activity to leave things as they are, then that's not good enough. We need in actual fact to be attacking the real problem, which is the oversized government for an 85,000 population.
Well, you're talking about rolling back the nanny state as well, but I'll come to that in a moment. What were you going to say, Geoffrey?
Well, I think that the figure of 15,000, I've been talking to people on the doorstep, and they see that as 15,000 new people coming to the island. I think what they're really saying, and it's poor rhetoric, is that we need 15,000 more jobs. Now, that may be people redeployed from the public sector into the private sector. It may be youngsters that we retain on
Ireland. It's got a lot to do with skills at that level, though, hasn't it?
Well, I think, you know, the money that's recently been announced, I think there are opportunities there for more apprenticeships and more vocational training on Ireland. There are a lot of people that think, oh, it's only the financial sector, but we all rely on plumbers, painters, decorators, mechanics, and they're jobs that require vocational training. And I think if we use some of that money to increase vocational training on the island, we will retain some of the people that we lose at the moment. And what we need is 15,000 more people in the private sector paying tax. And I agree with David. I think the public sector does need to become smaller over a longer term of time, but we can't suddenly cut the public sector. People have expectations in public services, and a lot has gone on under the radar, and in due course I think there will be some organic reduction.
I think the ability to be able to reduce quickly the size of government is not an easy task. I mean, we've already reduced the government by about 700 jobs up till now. But that process needs to continue with not replacing people who retire and so on. Government is too big and we need to reduce it, and that is the basic underlying problem. So we need to take a decision. Do we actually want services to gradually depreciate and keep the same level of economic activity? Or do, in actual fact, do we want services to be maintained by increasing government income, etc.
No, but if you take on 15,000 more people who are economically active and paying tax, there's an implication there that perhaps you're taking on their families and their children who might need education and other people who might need health services. It's not just 15,000 people, is it?
No.
It's a huge infrastructure issue.
But Roger, it depends where they come from, doesn't it? If they're redeployed from the public sector and they're youngsters that are already on island or people that are upskilling or changing skills, then they're necessarily coming on island. It's the old immigration issue, isn't it? But I have to go back to when I first came on island 30-odd years ago. I think the population then was 60,000, 65,000. It's now 85,000. Mm. And I don't think the island has suffered from that. And I think it's a better place in terms of services that are offered, shops and restaurants. The whole island has changed.
Yeah, but there is still a problem within our society, isn't there? I mean, David, we have food banks. We've got the growth of payday loan companies, which I know is one of your bugbears, and there's a variety of other things. I mean, it's not been all plain sailing.
No, not at all. I think the ability for all sectors of the island to actually prosper from our nation's activities is a really important point. And where services diminish, then there's bound to be some unrest, as I mentioned before. There's certain things we can address this by. We can certainly look at those points in particular where there is an issue. Certainly you mentioned food banks, you've mentioned homelessness, and these are real issues and perhaps have come as a shock to people on the Isle of Man to know that these are key issues at the moment. My particular initiative in bringing forward the credit union legislation will enable people to have banking facilities which perhaps they haven't had before, have a savings and the ability to borrow cheaply rather than falling into the hands of payday loans and loan sharks. I think this is a really important point, and certainly on the doorstep has received lots of applause.
What do you mean by the nanny state and rolling it back?
Well, I think over time what we've seen is that the centre government has decided that it'd be much more cheaper, much more beneficial if things are organised, aiming for economies of scale. However, what they've discovered both here and in the UK, particularly amongst local authorities, is that there aren't any benefits of scale to be had here. And overall, on balance, it's much better if in actual fact they're returned. And indeed, across at the moment, lots of local authorities are receiving lots more powers, lots more abilities to be able to work through issues in their own communities, which I think is really an important point. And actually, when you return jobs to the community can then decide, do we actually want to do them? How are we going to organise it? Is it something to do through the commissioners? Is it something that we can encourage local people to take initiatives themselves on, whether it's beach cleans, caring for each other in the community and so on? So I think the ability to be able to actually take control again of what's happening in the community is an opportunity that we're seeing at the moment.
But you reckon it is an opportunity because there are lots of local authorities that don't seem to be grasping the nettle.
Yeah, well, the transfer of services sort of forced that issue really for us because we've got to grasp that nettle. Otherwise, as the Minister has said, whether he meant it to come across that way or not, those who actually favour a 4+1 scheme will in actual fact gain in their ascendancy and will in fact want to see that introduced. But the way it's going at the moment, the cooperation that's existing between the Minister and local authorities means that we're actually winning on that one, and there's a great opportunity in the process of actually people being able to grasp the nettle and say, what can we do in our community?
You actually said we shouldn't wait for government to tell us what to do. That's in reference to local authorities. Is that what happens?
I think that's a key factor.
I think there are confused messages coming from David there. Let's go back to where we started on this. Nanny state, vulnerable people and all the rest of it, and retaining public services. Well, I think there's a bit of a mismatch between retaining public services and helping vulnerable people and cutting back the public sector. All right, there may be some inefficiencies there, but a lot of cuts have actually taken place. And you can't cut forever and not cut back public services, and public services are what protect and help vulnerable people. Now, we go on to the local authority issue. I support what's been going on, and I welcome, as a commissioner, some of the new powers that we've got. And I think that we can deliver better and more cheaply. But that's also an argument against this single legal entity. Small and local is often better than big and large. And I think you've got a bit of a mismatch there, David. I'm not quite sure where you're going.
But the local authorities cooperating together and government ministries cooperating together with their own sort of almost individual fiefdom are two different things.
Well, I think local authorities can cooperate. And,
what about government departments? This is the single entity issue we're back on to.
Well, I think departmentally, departments have to cooperate with each other. And as you've said earlier, the Treasury is overarching on everything. They produce the budget for the island and they give budgets to individual departments where ministers compete for them. I think that's part of the system, and the single legal entity won't do away with that competition for funding.
I think the issue really here, Roger, is what goodwill is there in the community that we can use as opposed to it being a burden on the taxpayer or the ratepayer. I think there's a huge amount, particularly amongst older people, who we tend to ignore, call them a burden, call them a drain, call them a time bomb about to take off. And I think there's a lot of goodwill there which we can use and tap into. So
Do you do that, David?
Well, by leadership, by an actual fact, bringing to the fore ideas and initiatives which enable people to participate. I mean, we're always seen to be short when it comes to local commissioner elections of people who are prepared to come forward. But I think we need to encourage people to do that and participate in the community and to be able to bring forward their skills, which we desperately need. And I think you keep referring to people as a burden and as
no,
a drain.
No, I've not. You're using that terminology, I certainly don't see old people as a burden. They're an asset. They paid their way. A lot of them are actually continuing to work, and we'll do so. We're getting older, and I don't see myself as being a burden on the state
I
get older.
Right. Well, those are the state's words.
I'm going to go to a break in a moment, but let me just deal with this one more bit about this older people before we go. You are recommending, David, that we have a commissioner for older people. What would he do or she do?
I think it's important that we do have that, because if you've got somebody who's looking at the implications of legislation that's being brought forward, if you have people coordinating the work that goes on between the third sector and government, I think that would be a vital ingredient and a facilitator of bringing forward the goodwill, I think, that's in the community out there to do some of the tasks at the moment which are undertaken by ratepayer and the taxpayer.
What power would he have?
But I think it's patronising, really, to talk about a commissioner for older people. And David, you're talking about cutbacks in the public sector. You're already talking about increasing and adding another post to the public sector. Someone will have to pay for that. And I don't think old people want a commissioner. People that I speak to are not talking to me about having a commissioner for older people.
They've
got a voice. But you are right in terms of voluntary work. We find it difficult, as you do, Patrick, to find people to serve on commissioners. And unfortunately, the younger ones who probably have good skill sets are too busy. And some of the older people are too busy being retired to want to engage.
I think the important thing, though, is that this is actually already taking place in other jurisdictions. And they've already shown that this is an actual fact. Works because in Northern Ireland, for example, they have a commissioner for older people. They've done a survey recently which demonstrates the amount of tax that is actually paid into the system, which is well over and above the actual cost of older people. And I think we need to, in actual fact, we need to come to a point where we actually show far greater respect for our older people and actually give them the space that they deserve.
Now, what we're doing in this conversation now, we're highlighting things. I mean, when you look through many Manx manifestos for political office, they don't contain a lot of long-term policy or political philosophy or original thinking. Most are a wish list designed to catch the imagination of the potential voter. Now, listening to both of you today, you're doing that very well. But, I mean, I'm still not absolutely clear. If you're elected in next week, what you will do and what you think you will achieve, and if you survive into the next 5 years, what are you actually going to do with all this lot? This is now as a wish list so far.
Well, manifesto, it is a vision, because that's all it can be at the moment. But it lets people know where I'm coming from. I mean, I believe passionately in growing the economy. I think we need to have more taxpayers. We need to preserve public services, but we need to make them more efficient. I don't like to see cosmetic changes, single legal entity, whatever. I agree entirely with what's been happening with local authorities and delegating, but I'm also aware that that is a way of central government moving cost the local rate.
I have to go to a break in a moment. Now, if we just come outside that for a minute and go to you then, David, and I say to you, right, well, what's your core political philosophy then? Long term, what would you hope to?
Well, I think it's rather defeatist to say that we can't achieve anything in the next 12 months. I think we can achieve quite a bit, certainly in terms of the two things I've just mentioned earlier. I think they are quite achievable. And I think certainly the matters in the constituency that need achieving. In actual fact, what we're talking about is rolling up our sleeves and get stuck into whatever job comes our way, whatever we see in the constituency that needs to be done.
OK, now we'll take a short commercial break and return with more from the Glenfaber candidates in just 2 minutes.
In a recent survey of world leaders, it was found not a single one was called Maureen. Why? Who knows? Perhaps Maureens have more important things to do with their time. Take Maureen 118212 Directories. She finds numbers. Will Barack do that or that French guy? Je think not. Well, Maureen might be good with numbers, but Cowley Groves is good with houses. Cowley Groves, for sound advice on buying, selling or letting on the Isle of Man. Your friendly, independent property professionals. Take a look on CowleyGroves.com. Maureen is good with numbers, but hey, Cowley Groves is good with houses.
Wouldn't your office benefit from a refit? You'll find some fresh inspiration from the office design experts in the new Descon catalogue out now. Get your free copy for great ideas on office space saving and storage, along with the latest office layouts. Descon will refit and improve any office to make the work environment a pleasant, efficient place to be. Just call Descon on 616939 for your free catalogue. Visit Descon on Facebook or at desconlimited.com.
What does £3 get you these days? Did you say not a lot? You need to check out your local Subway. Right now, £3 is all it takes to get the real deal. A range of delicious 6-inch subs to choose from, plus your choice of a hot or cold drink. Complete with a smiling welcome and speedy service. The £3 real deal, only in Subway. Chester Street, Douglas, Derby Road, Peel and Brighton Street, Port Erin now. Subway, eat fresh. Participation may vary. See in store for details.
If you love Sundays, you'll love The Strand.
Relax with a coffee in our cafe and browse our two great floors. Whether you're looking for that perfect gift or fancy treating yourself, come and enjoy the perfect Sunday shopping experience all under one roof. We've a fabulous range of shops for everyone. It's the perfect trip out for the whole family this Sunday. Go to thestrand.co.in and follow us on Twitter and Facebook for news and upcoming events.
Love shopping. Love Sundays. Love The Strand.
In this election special, we're meeting the candidates in the forthcoming House of Keys by-election for the constituency of Glenfaber, which takes place next Thursday, the 10th of September. The two who are contesting the seat are with me in the studio today, and they are David Talbot and Geoffrey Boot. Well, we talked about a number of topics going up to the break there, gentlemen, but we haven't dealt with yet, bearing in mind this is a national government and not a local government, we haven't dealt a lot yet with international affairs. Now, Geoffrey, you, in your manifesto, talk about more independence, and you also talk about legislation creep from the United Kingdom. Well, first of all, maybe we'd deal with the second one first. Can you illustrate what you mean by that?
Well, I think a lot of things that we do on the island are influenced or done as a result of EU or UK regulation or legislation. I just go back to one that I recall and is still causing problems. We closed all our local abattoirs down and built a big meat plant, which cost us an awful lot of money, and it's still a burden. Something we can't lose, but we did that, and it was perpetrated on the back of EU legislation and requirements. And the airport spent a lot of money on fencing and a runway extension and a new tower to meet certain standards. Some of that fed through from the UK. But if you look at smaller businesses and the way they have to react to HR requirements and health and safety legislation, it all imposes a bigger burden on our business. And sometimes these burdens are to address issues in other jurisdictions, not on Ireland. And I think we ought to tailor our legislation and regulation to the problems we have on Ireland.
What do you make of that, David?
I think if we're part of the EU, regrettably, we've got to take on board the fact that We need to, in actual fact.
But we're not part of the EU, David. That is just the question. We're Protocol 3 signatories, which binds us to common duty and VAT.
Let's see what David's going to say there, because I think you were making a point there, David.
I think the point is that whilst we're not actually in the EU, we still have to comply through Protocol 3 with regulation if we actually want to trade there. So, unfortunately, we've got several civil servants who are actually work away to monitor that European legislation, and as such, we are tied into that. So we can't, in actual fact, decide to actually have different regulations if, in actual fact, we want to continue to trade with the EU in the way that we are.
Well, trade without barriers, I understand, is the purpose of Protocol 3 more than trade, I think.
It is indeed, but let's be realistic about this. We're a small jurisdiction, and most of our trade is actually with the UK and internationally on the financial services sector, and Europe has not been good to us on the financial services
Protocol 3 doesn't cover that.
I know, but we seem to have enacted quite a lot of regulation that we don't need to. Perhaps we should have waited and see what happens. We're driving away financial services. But, you know, I come to things like red meat derogation that used to protect our farmers' meat production. That was traded by the UK. Yeah, red meat. That was traded by the UK with the EU. Why did that happen? We didn't seem to have any influence on it, and we need to protect some of our local markets. The big game changer, of course, is this morning I read that for the first time the no vote in the UK for leaving the EU is in the lead. In 12 months' time, we might be facing a whole new scenario with the UK coming out of the EU, and all Protocol 3 will be thrown away, and we'll have to start from scratch.
Well, it might still not affect us quite like that, of course, though, because it's we still be there. But how much of value is this? I mean, Tyndall, David, every month virtually, or certainly at regular intervals, gets a schedule of EU legislation that's applied to the Isle of Man, but they're just giving it for information. There's no vote or debate about it.
Yeah, these things travel through. As I said, if we want to trade in the way we are, then we've got to go along with this. But there are lots of things that we could do, which we don't need to just go along with. We need to think carefully through some of the issues that's been mentioned and make sure that we start to take initiatives rather than always having to just go along with the issues that are brought before us.
But you talk about we want to trade with Europe. A lot of countries trade with Europe, and they don't enact all EU regulation. And Roger's absolutely correct. This list of regulation is presented, but there is no democratic debate on whether it's useful for us as an island community. It's just adopted, and I think that is very poor.
What about the general relationship with the United Kingdom, David, our constitutional position there now? I mean, do you accept it? Do you think that it's working in our favour? Do you think it needs revising?
I think that the tide that's gradually coming over us, just carrying on from this point about the European Union, it's not just a matter of the Isle of Man is having to comply. The United Kingdom itself is having to comply. This is what the vote is all about whenever it comes about the in-out option. So therefore, we have to look very carefully at our relationship, both from a commercial point of view, in other words, the VAT sharing agreement, for example, and do we move towards greater independence as a nation? Certainly the VAT sharing agreement is something that we can look at. Treasury have always said that both now and retrospectively it would be good to actually stay in, but we've always had this idea that the Treasury Minister himself has had to act with one arm tied behind the back, because we can't actually control the level of indirect taxation. So I think as we get washed over with more and more regulation from outside of the arm, we ought to be looking at our own position.
What about, though, coming back to this relationship with the United Kingdom? I mean, you talked about a nanny state in the past, our nanny state, but there is a sort of paternalistic or a colonial view about the Isle of Man that exists in the UK.
I think there is a lot of naivety in the UK about what happens on the Isle of Man. I know a number of MPs and MEPs, and you talk to them about the Isle of Man, and some think we're the Isle of Wight, and they don't understand the dynamics. And I think that's a great shame. We need to do more in educating
Well, if you
UK
were elected, how would you do more?
Well, I already know a lot of MPs and MEPs. I think that it would be beholden on the government to enable me to talk to people. And I think having...
Well, of course, government knows a lot of MEPs and
well,
MPs
they do,
as well.
But I've been to most of the major party conferences over the years, and the Channel Islands are there, the Gibraltar Maltese are there, the Falkland Islanders are there, but there are no stands for the Isle of Man. There's no receptions for the Isle of Man. People don't seem to even register the Isle of Man. And I think we need to promote ourselves. But the UK, there was a report just before the last election that the UK government commissioned, and it admitted, and this is a UK report, that they were having undue influence over what happened on the island. And I think we need to stand up for ourselves. The Scottish, you know, are seeking more independence. We already have that level of independence, but on occasions, we just don't use it.
Well, if you were elected, David, would you say no, try to say no, or do you see the need to say no?
I think from time to time, so we need to stand up for ourselves. The impression given all the Vat-Sharing agreement was that we walked all over and that we didn't, in actual fact, stand up to...
Well, Alan Bell's comment when asked that said, might is right.
Well, it wasn't the perception of the general public. The general public actually thought that we'd been walked all over. And I think we need to flex our muscles a little bit more when it comes to relationship with the United Kingdom.
Well, I would like to know. I've never seen a definitive study as to whether we are on the right side or the wrong side of the present VAT arrangement.
Well, there is, of course, some figures due out shortly, isn't there? We've been expecting them for some time now.
I'm hoping that will show us something, and then we can make a reasoned decision.
Right. Okay, now let's look at one or two other points before that we come to the end of our programme. We've just got a few minutes to go now. But both of you refer to sea and air travel, of course, which is fundamental to an island community. Do you agree with continuing with the sea monopoly as it is and renewing the user agreement, David?
Well, the Minister has put out expressions of interest, and he says he's got several that have come forward. However, we need to make some fairly quick decisions because the steam packet needs to consider the landing stage at Liverpool. It's got investments that it needs to make. So I think it's only fair on the existing operator that we come to a conclusion as to whether we're going to invite others into the marketplace.
Right. Well, I agree with that to a certain extent, but I think that we really need some proper figures from the ferry operators on profitability and the cost of the carriage at the moment. It is a key factor that businesses consider for individuals as well. It's a prime cost. You can get over the channel, for instance, for pounds, you know, £10 return. You're lucky if you can get a car backwards and forwards for under £200. And I would like to drill down on their figures and profitability to find out whether they're on the right side of the user agreement or we are. And I understand the need to have a service that operates all year round on a constant basis, because without it, it's our lifeline.
But isn't that what the people who are monitoring the user agreement do anyway?
Well, I don't know, because I've not seen any firm figures. Well, have you seen profitability figures?
I certainly haven't. I think certainly the government itself has the power to be able to control prices, and it has the power to be able to veto any price increases that come through. So I think it's very important that if we're talking about fair, because this is a private company at the end of the day, and I think that if we want to introduce more competition, that has been tried before, but at the most moment in time, over the last 20 odd years or so, nobody has come forward with a scheme that's actually lasted as such.
Now, we talked about it before, the customs and excise agreement with the United Kingdom, and I just said we're waiting for the latest results. But you were talking before about reviewing the customs and excise agreement to see what perhaps we should do about it. And I noticed in the manifestos there was talk about getting an arrangement more similar to Jersey and the Channel Islands. But as far as I understand it, we got the best of the deal, haven't we? Guernsey and Jersey would give their eye teeth to have our deal.
I didn't suggest that. I think that Jersey and Guernsey operate the way they do because that's the way they've always operated. And from a citizen's point of view, they probably have a better deal in not paying VAT at 20%. And they enjoy that. But from an island point of view, we need real figures, hard figures, to decide which way we go. And I don't personally see the situation at the moment that we're going to leave the VAT agreement, because I think there are big implications for us if we're not careful.
Well, if you notice that during all our conversation, I do seem to be focusing my attention anyway on not just the theory, not just the highlighting the issues, but the actual practical outcome of doing something with those issues, which whichever one of you gentlemen is successful next Thursday, I mean, you will have to start doing. So, in conclusion, in about half a minute each, would you please now tell us why you believe that the voters in Glenfarne should invest their one vote in you, David?
Okay, I think whatever I've done in my life, whether it's family, whether it's business, whether it's public service, I've always worked hard at whatever that is. And I think the best way of engaging with any task that you're given is to actually spend time reviewing that and then to come forward with your suggestions when you thoroughly understand what's going on, the figures, the culture, and so on and so forth. And then hopefully the staff themselves think it's them that have brought forward the idea. So what I'm committing myself to do is to work hard at whatever task that is put before me, and I've got a good track record which demonstrates that.
Right, Geoffrey Boot.
Yes, well, the electors have had our manifestos, we've talked on the doorstep, and they've listened to this debate. I'm sure most of them will have made up their minds. Both of us are from a business background, and I think that's good for Tynwald. But I believe my record in communication, business on and off island, and politics on and off island gives me the edge. I just hope the electors see it that way.
Right, well, the elevation of David Anderson to the Legislative Council has caused a by-election in the Glenfarb constituency, and in today's election special, we've been talking to the two candidates, David Talbot, a Chartered Secretary and Accountant, and a Patrick Commissioner, and Geoffrey Boot, a Company Director and a German Commissioner. The election takes place next Thursday, the 10th of September, and the polling stations for Glenfarb are number 1 in St John's Methodist Hall, Main Road, St John's, number 2, St Paul's Church, Mine Road, Foxdale, and number 3, Glenmay Methodist Church, Glenmay. And all three stations open at 8 in the morning and close at 8 in the evening. This will be the last general election for Glenfarb as it is now. For the 2016 election, it will be merged with Peel to form one new and larger constituency. If you'd like to hear again any part of this programme, it'll be available on Manx Radio's website, www.manxradio.com, on the on-demand section later, and also in the election special section. And we'll revisit the by-elections again at 1:05 today, when in a second election special, we'll meet the four candidates for Peel. The producer was Catherine Nicol, I'm Roger Watterson, and we look forward to your company once more after the news.